Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, July 8, 2020. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Midland Memorial Hospital Begins Surge Plan as Hospitalizations Spike, by Caitlin Randall. With its COVID-19 units near capacity, Midland Memorial officials announced they're implementing the first steps of their surge plan to increase the number of beds available for coronavirus patients. The hospital had 29 coronavirus patients on Tuesday, 10 in the critical care unit and 19 in the regular COVID-19 unit. CEO Russell Myers said during a press conference, officials have previously said those units have a capacity of 12 beds and 24 beds, respectively. Some coronavirus patients have been moved to the 8th floor of the hospital, which staff are now converting into a COVID-19 ward, said Chief Nursing Officer Kit Breedemus. That floor is ordinarily used for elective surgeries, but Myers said last week that inpatient elective surgeries have been limited to ensure the hospital has space for virus patients. 6 to 12 beds are being added to the critical care COVID-19 unit for a capacity of 24, Breedemus said. Additionally, construction is ongoing at the Scarborough Tower, where the 9th floor is being expanded and would add a 48-bed unit. It will be built with critical care capacity, so should we need dramatic expansion of critical care going into the fall and early winter, we'll be prepared to do that, Myers said. But while that unit is being built, the hospital faced the possibility of having to cut back elective surgeries further, as well as the challenge of staffing the additional beds they're adding to the rotation. Probably the biggest question we have is how we're going to staff increases in beds, increases in critical care capacity, which we're prepared to do from a physical standpoint, but it's much harder to just create critical care nurses out of thin air, Myers said. And so we're actively sourcing traveling nursing staff and trying to prepare for what we see on the horizon as continued growth. Also discussed during Tuesday's press briefing, Myers said the hospital's testing location is now seeing a positivity rate of 30%. Among those tested, a significant increase, which he called an interesting and concerning trend. Midland Memorial has received more vials of remdesivir, the only FDA-approved treatment for COVID-19. The last allotment the hospital received was for 72 vials, enough for 10 to 12 patients, Chief Medical Officer Dr. Larry Wilson said. The hospital currently has 10 patients on ventilators, about the most they've had through the duration of the pandemic, Myers said. This article is entitled, Total for Fire Police Budgets Top $68 Million. City Staff Presents Preliminary Budget for Fiscal Year 2021, by Stuart Doreen. Police and fire department expenditures will make up around 50% of the $136 million budget in general fund expenditures, according to the city's preliminary budget for fiscal year 2021. The Midland City Council held a budget workshop on Tuesday, and city leaders learned the next budget, if approved, will have $35.266 million for Midland Police Department and $32.866 million for Midland Fire Department. It was stated during the meeting that there isn't one single source of revenue that covers the combined budgets of both departments. It is expected that property taxes will be the single largest revenue source for the upcoming fiscal year, $51.978 million. Sales tax isn't far behind, as the forecast calls for $49.733 million in the upcoming fiscal year. The workshop also provided a first look at the proposed tax rate. City staff showed a proposed tax rate of 36.7061 cents per $100 valuation. That would be higher than the effective or no new revenue rate of 35.4648 cents and higher than the current fiscal year's tax rate of 36.4715 cents per $100 valuation. The rate still will be lower than the tax rate that would require voter approval. City documents show that the fiscal year 2020 rate brought in $57.591 million. There wasn't much discussion during the online workshop about the tax rate in terms of whether it was too high or too low. The budget session allowed each member who was present to take in information about expenditures and revenue, learn the history of past budgets, and go over the calendar. The council is tentatively scheduled to establish a proposed tax rate on July 28th. A public hearing on the budget and tax increase is set for August 25th. Also that day will be first readings of the ordinances to adopt a tax rate and budget. Second readings are set for September 8th. Budget highlights include the reduction of 26 positions, no cost of living increases, the creation of 9 new positions, including a superintendent to manage the sports complex and another to lead the new senior services division, and police department expenditures having to do with lieutenant pay, additional overtime, and certification pay. The budget proposed by city staff maintains $6 million in street maintenance and $4.6 million in street improvements. That money is on top of the funds from the road bond passed in 2017. There is also a $7.7 million included for the replacement and purchase of new vehicles, including 2 ambulances, 1 fire engine, and 8 police package SUVs. The proposed budget also shows around $69 million in its general fund balance savings. City officials also reported the average home value increased from $269,475 in 2020 to $272,779 in 2021. Taxes rose accordingly from $982.82 to $1,001.27. This article is entitled Walk-On's Bistro Receives Liquor Permit by Mella McEwen. Walk-On's Sports Bistro, the restaurant business owned by New Orleans Saints quarterback Drew Brees, received its liquor permit at Monday's meeting of the Planning and Zoning Commission. The commissioners unanimously approved the request by Slam Dunk Food No. 2, LLC, for a specific use designation with term for the sale of all alcoholic beverages for on-premises consumption at the resident, currently under construction at 4605 Whitman Drive. The 9,904-square-foot restaurant will include 6,728 square feet dedicated to alcohol sales, including a covered beer garden and covered porch. Proposed hours will be from 11 a.m. to 11 p.m., Sunday through Thursday, and 11 a.m. to midnight, Friday and Saturday. Commissioners also unanimously approved a request by James Tynes Jr. for a specific use designation with term for the sale of all alcoholic beverages for on-premises consumption in a restaurant. The Sweet Pot, which is not currently in operation, will be in Suite G in the shopping center at 210 West Longview Avenue. The 2,400-square-foot restaurant will include a dining area and alcohol-serviceable area of about 1,432 square feet. A request by Rosa R. Ramirez for a specific use designation with term for a child care daycare center also received unanimous approval. Mrs. Rosa's Learning Center will be developed on 2 lots at 101 West Parker Avenue. One building will be a 2,400-square-foot learning center, and the second building will be a 3,100-square-foot multipurpose building that will include office space. Hours will be 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday. Commissioners, however, denied by a 3-2 vote a request by Jaime Alvarado Lopez for a zone change from SF3, a single-family dwelling district, to 2F, a two-family dwelling duplex district, so he could build a duplex at 418 East Hicks Avenue. In other action, commissioners approved a proposed final plat of Country Sky Edition at Roadrunner Trail and Briarwood Avenue. The applicant sought to replat the property at 4409 Roadrunner Trail into 3 lots for ownership purposes. a proposed preliminary plat of Southern Addition at South Weatherford Street and East Washington Avenue. Delta Land Surveying had proposed replatting four lots into one to obtain a permit to build a house. Two requests by Jorge Chavez for zone changes from MF22, Multiple Family Dwelling District, to SF3, Single Family Dwelling District, at 304 South Clay Street and 505 South Clay in order to build houses. This article is entitled West Texas Food Bank Seeks Donations for Summer Match by J.C. Lewis. The West Texas Food Bank is seeking donations for a summer match. The Wayne and Joanne Moore Charitable Foundation has offered to match $100,000 in donations to meet increased food demand in the area as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. WTFB Director of Marketing and Communications Craig Stoker said, "The West Texas Food Bank has entered the fifth month of falling oil prices, the pandemic, and schools being closed. Donations made now and before the August 31st deadline, up to $100,000, will be matched for a total impact of $200,000. It has been our busiest year ever," Stoker said. "This past month, we passed what we did last year. Last year, we distributed about 6.5 million pounds of food. We hit that last month, and we still have 3 months left in our fiscal year." He said the food bank expects to continue at the current rate, which will put them at distributing between 9.5 and 10 million pounds of food this year. "When we built our new facilities and moved in 4 years ago, those facilities were designed to distribute 10 million pounds of food a year. But we thought the need would be that great 15 years from now, not now," he said. "We are a little ahead of schedule on that." He said members of the community continue to donate funds so the food bank can buy necessary items and keep fuel in the trucks. The nonprofit has also had to make emergency trips to outlying counties. The WTFB made a trip on June 30th to Terlingua, where their partners had to close because of the coronavirus. During the trip, they served more than 250 families. "We make trips once a month down there, but the two agencies we partner with in Terlingua had to close," Stoker said. "We had to show up to serve the community where a traditional pantry was typically serving. We are working with the agencies to make sure those communities are served, and if that means we have to go down there, we go." He said demand could very well go up if state pauses in reopening. "With things going in the other direction as far as opening up, we anticipate the demand. If it doesn't stay the same, it will increase," Stoker said. "Now we've got a large chunk of our population that works in bars or restaurants who don't have a paycheck at all or aren't getting tips that make up the bulk of their paycheck. There is a whole group of people who are going to be needing what we provide. Need help? For more information on the service provided by the West Texas Food Bank, visit WTXFoodBank.org or call 211. Want to donate? Donations can be made at bit.ly/3E66TK3. This article is entitled National Weather Service, Get Ready for 108 Degrees by Stuart Doreen. The 90-plus degree day on Tuesday is giving way to 100 degree days in the forecast for an extended period. The National Weather Service reported Tuesday that every day of the 7-day forecast shows high temperatures in the hundreds, as high as 108, and lows in the upper 70s. An upper ridge over the area is intensifying, according to the National Weather Service, and combined with winds that will come out of the west on Sunday or Monday, that could bring the extreme high temperatures. The National Weather Service shows high temperatures reaching 105 degrees on Saturday, 106 on Sunday, and 108 on Monday and Tuesday. The 7 straight days of 100-degree temperatures would add to the 19 days at or above 100 degrees this calendar year. The summer already has been above average in terms of temperature. However, the expected high temperatures could be as much as 13 degrees above normal for this time of year. With lows in the upper 70s, that means there will be no relief at night, as the average low temperature for this time of year is 70 degrees. The National Weather Service also reports that if the forecast plays out as forecasted, the number of days at or above 105 degrees will be one of the longer streaks on record in Midland. There also is no rain in the forecast through at least Monday, according to the National Weather Service. This article is entitled, TWC Seeks Repayment of $32 Million in Benefits, by Juan Pablo Garnham, Texas Tribune. More than 46,000 Texans who lost their jobs in recent months were initially overpaid by the Texas Workforce Commission, which now wants $32 million back in unemployment benefits. State law requires TWC to recover all unemployment benefit overpayments, Cisco Gomez, spokesman for the state agency, said in an email. Overpayments stay on your record until repaid. It's unclear how many of those overpayments, first reported by the Houston Chronicle, are due to fraud and how many are due to TWC's errors. The agency had not responded to requests for that information by late Monday. The agency also did not immediately provide the average amount that was overpaid. Benefits must be repaid even if the state is to blame for the overpayment or if it was otherwise not the recipient's fault. If TWC finds unemployment fraud in a case, the person has to give back the benefits and pay a 15% penalty. Gomez on Monday originally said that the agency cannot pay someone benefits if they have been previously overpaid. But later Monday, he said the agency eliminated that rule earlier this year. If the person that received the notification of overpayment doesn't send back the money, the state controller can recover the money by withholding certain funds, including lottery winnings, unclaimed property, unemployment benefits, and other state-related job expenses. Some state funding for college students cannot be released until a repayment is made in full. Claimants who have received notices can appeal the process, but TWC can take legal action too if they don't recover the money. There is no statute of limitations on debts owed to the state, Gomez said in an email. TWC cannot forgive or dismiss the overpayment, and there is no exception for hardship. James Richards is one of the people that is being asked for part of his unemployment benefits back. Last year, after a heart attack, he had to stop working as a welder at a company that builds construction equipment in Fort Worth. His supervisor gave him a new job as a janitor, but as business slowed down due to the pandemic, he was let go in late March. Without a salary, he depended on the unemployment checks to pay for his doctor appointments and medications. They sent me two checks for $1,700, but then they canceled it and sent me a bill to get $1,700 back, the 47-year-old said. According to the correspondence from Texas Workforce Commission, they were revoking his benefits because allegedly he left the company on his own. But Richard said that wasn't the case and is currently appealing. In the meantime, he is depending on his partner's salary as a teacher to pay their mortgage. I'm feeling frustrated. This should never have been taken away in the first place, Richard said. Now I'm in a position that I can't afford my truck. I'm not able to go to the doctor. I don't have any of my income. We're just trying to afford the house. As of late June, 2.7 million Texans had filed for unemployment relief since mid-March, but TWC has struggled to keep up with the high levels of demand. Since the pandemic started, countless Texans have experienced problems accessing their benefits, encountering busy phone lines, and an overwhelmed application website. This is the local and state page. This article is entitled City, Two More Midland County Residents Die of Coronavirus, by Stuart Doreen. The Midland Health Department reported two more Midland County residents died of coronavirus for the second straight day. The health department's four COVID-19 deaths this week bring the total during the pandemic to 19. A man in his 60s died Saturday, and a woman in her 70s died Monday. Both were being treated at Midland Memorial Hospital. As the number of fatalities increased, so did the number of Midland County residents being confirmed with coronavirus. Another 49 cases were reported Tuesday, bringing the total this week to 204, and the total during the pandemic to 976. More than two-thirds of coronavirus cases in Midland County are active, as the number of people self-isolating at home increased to 677. Those said to have recovered are increased by 1 to 250. There are 20 inpatients at the hospital with the virus. Midland Health Department officials also reported that the source of exposure for more than half of the cases on Tuesday was community transmission, and that those 40 to 49 made up the largest share of those testing positive, 12. The 20-somethings and 30-somethings each had 9. This is the opinion page. This column is entitled, Depiction of Mount Rushmore Speech, Not Anomaly, by Mark Thiessen, Washington Post Writers Group. I missed President Donald Trump's Mount Rushmore speech Friday night, so when I read the press coverage over the weekend, I braced for the worst. The New York Times reported that Trump had delivered an ominous depiction of the recent protests over racial justice and exploited race and cultural flashpoints to stoke fear among his base of white supporters. The Associated Press declared that he had accused protesters who have pushed for racial justice of engaging in a merciless campaign to wipe out our history. Then I watched the full address. None of it was true. "We embrace tolerance, not prejudice," Trump said. "Every child of every color, born and unborn, is made in the holy image of God." He praised great black Americans, including Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, Jesse Owens, Louis Armstrong, Ella Fitzgerald, and Muhammad Ali, declaring that only America could have produced them all. Standing beneath the image of Abraham Lincoln, Trump declared, "Lincoln won the Civil War. He issued the Emancipation Proclamation. He led the passage of the 13th Amendment, abolishing slavery for all time." The crowd cheered at his mention of abolition of slavery, which got zero mentions in the coverage of his address. Trump explained that by tearing down Washington and Jefferson, these radicals would tear down the principles that propelled the abolition of slavery in America and ultimately around the world, ending an evil institution that had plagued humanity for thousands and thousands of years, he declared. "Our opponents would tear apart the very documents that Martin Luther King used to express his dream and the ideas that were the foundation of the righteous movement for civil rights. To the Times, this amounts to stoking racial fears to pit a white voting base against nationwide calls for social justice." The mischaracterization of the Mount Rushmore speech is not an anomaly. Trump's critics in the media have fallen into an insidious habit of taking his quotes and criticizing the hordes who burn buildings and tear down statues, and reporting them as criticism of racial justice protesters. This is dishonest. Trump has said more than once that he is an ally of all peaceful protesters. He's not the one blurring the lines between violent mobs and peaceful protesters. His media critics are. They know most Americans oppose the mob, but support racial justice, and so they twist Trump's words to make it seem like he opposes both. Trump says and tweets plenty of outrageous things, but that doesn't give reporters license to make them up. Trump believes that if you give an inch to the cancel culture, it's a slippery slope. Nearly 3 years ago, he warned that if we take down statues of Robert E. Lee, soon they'll come after George Washington. Well, as Megan McArdle pointed out in the Washington Post, he was prescient. "I happen to think we should have national conversation about Confederate monuments and that Trump would be in a stronger position to defend the American founding if he had one." But you can't have a national conversation with a mob. And the rioters tearing down and defacing statues and memorials of Washington, Lincoln, and Ulysses S. Grant have proven they are not just opposed to the Confederacy, they're opposed to the Union. What about the charge that he declared a culture war? That is like saying that America declared war on Japan. It's technically correct, but misses the point. The left launched a culture war and cancel culture that, as Trump said, is driving people from their jobs, shaming dissenters, and demanding total submission from anyone who disagrees. The president is simply fighting back against this war of political intolerance, and it's about time someone did. The iconoclasm we see today is rooted in a broader movement that seeks to cancel and discredit the American founding. One Times reporter's Twitter header photo literally shows the words July 4th, 1776, with a line drawn through, replaced by August 20th, 1619, the date the first enslaved Africans arrived at Jamestown. At Mount Rushmore, Trump declared that no one will cancel the American founding on his watch. That is only controversial in bluest reaches of blue America. If celebrating and defending our founding principles on 4th of July is dark and divisive, that tells us less about Trump than the sad state of our country. This is Letters to the Editor. Prop A could provide quality health care. A successful community must have quality health care available for all of its citizens. Midlanders can contribute to that reality by voting yes on Proposition A on July 14th. A yes vote means Midland Memorial Hospital will be able to continue providing that health care with addition of funds from a 1/4 cent sales tax on non-essential items sold in Midland County. There are a lot of reasons a hospital district needs the added income and why a sales tax is far better than a property tax to achieve it. Rather than going into those details, I will refer readers to the excellent articles in Sunday's Reporter-Telegram on the subject written by Tim Dunn and Nadine Craddock. I agree with both and want to add my encouragement that we all make the effort to cast our vote in the July 14th election and say yes to Proposition A. Signed, Ernest Angelo Jr., former mayor of Midland. State's district court schedule is overloaded. Our judicial system provides an indigent criminal defendant with a free lawyer, a free trial, and a free appeal if convicted. Defendants claim indigence so as to enjoy these benefits. As a result, the district courts across the state are swamped with criminal case trials. In Midland County, the felony cases received by the district attorney from the grand jury are assigned on a rotation basis to four courts. Judge David Lindemood's Domestic Relations Court is exempt. So the remaining four district courts bear the criminal trial burden. Civil trial cases are not filed in courts chosen by the lawyers, but by rotation among the four district courts. The judge of the 142nd District Court will be expected to move the heavy criminal trial docket and all other assigned cases. The district court judges are not allowed to choose a particular type of caseload that suits their preferences. Instead, they move all the cases assigned to that court, primarily felony criminal trial cases. Vote in this important runoff election July 14th for David Rogers for judge of the 142nd District Court. Signed, Al Walvoord, retired judge. This column is entitled Patriotism Equated with White Supremacy by Rich Lowry, King Features Syndicate. If nothing else, President Donald Trump's July 4th speech at Mount Rushmore clarified the battle lines of our culture war. The New York Times called the speech, quote, dark and divisive, unquote, while an Associated Press headline declared, quote, Trump pushes racial division, unquote. A Washington Post story said the speech crystallized the president's, quote, unyielding push to preserve Confederate symbols and the legacy of white domination, unquote. Democratic Senator Tammy Duckworth insisted that Trump spent all his time talking about dead traitors. To be clear, and despite all of this, the media and the left didn't freak out about a speech extolling the valor of Robert E. Lee, the statesmanship of Jefferson Davis, or the prowess of Nation Bedford Forrest. They didn't scorn a speech pining for antebellum America or expressing ambiguity about the Civil War. They didn't pan a speech that slighted the quest for justice and civil rights throughout American history. As a matter of fact, Trump didn't mention any Confederates at all. He hailed Abraham Lincoln at length and called the Civil War the struggle that saved our nation and extinguished the evil of slavery. He slighted the repulsive Pickett's charge and quoted the battle hymn of the Republic. He said, "We must defend the principles that propelled the abolition of slavery in America and the ideas that were the foundation of righteous movement for civil rights." It'd be difficult to get a more textbook expression of the American civic religion than the speech at Rushmore. It'd be difficult to get a more wide-ranging appreciation of the warriors, inventors, adventurers, reformers, entertainers, and athletes that have made the country what it is. It'd be difficult to get a more affirming account of the greatness of America and its meaning to the world. And yet, the speech was tested and found wanting. Trump's attacks on what he called a new far-left fascism and a cultural revolution designed to overthrow the American Revolution were indeed hard-edged. But who can doubt the basic truth of these claims? There's a fear afoot in the land as a merciless authoritarian spirit informs a spate of firings and cancellations. The day before Trump's speech, a Boeing executive resigned over something he had written in 1987. Protesters have targeted commemorations of every single one of the presidents etched on Mount Rushmore, who the day before yesterday would have been completely unassailable giants of American history. Vandals splashed red paint on statues of Washington in New York City, and the aforementioned Tammy Baldwin said she's open to having a conversation about whether statues of the father of the country should still stand. The setting for Trump's speech is itself now deemed problematic. A CNN report previewing the event said, "Trump will be at Mount Rushmore, where he'll be standing in front of a monument of two slave owners and on land wrestled away from Native Americans." There's no doubt that Trump is a deeply flawed messenger. Indeed, days after the speech, he out of nowhere attacked NASCAR on Twitter for banning the display of Confederate flags. But it wasn't just Trump the messenger who was attacked in the aftermath of the Mount Rushmore speech. It was the message. Patriotic statements of the sort that have adorned American oratory for centuries were deemed hateful and divisive. A celebration of the founders that once would have been the stuff of schoolbooks and primers was considered controversial. A defense of the nation's ideals was only waved away. Nope, nothing to see here, only hate and division. Surely, if some other Republican president had given the Mount Rushmore speech, the pushback wouldn't have been as intense. But this isn't just about Trump. It goes much deeper. Critics of the speech objected to what they said was its wildly exaggerated account of the stakes in the culture war, and at the same time vindicated that account by equating patriotism with white supremacy. This is the obituary column, Wednesday, July 8, 2020. Ada Ray Duke. Ada Ray Duke passed away after a long illness at home on June 23, 2020, with her family by her side. She was born on August 12, 1936, to Carl and Ethel Brunken in Greeley, Colorado. Ada is preceded in death by her husband, Bobby B. Duke, daughter, Patty Duke, and husband, Kevin Mahoney. Her parents, Carl and Ethel, and several brothers and sisters. She leaves behind her daughter, Jennifer Linton, and husband, John. 5 grandchildren, 2 great-grandchildren. Sister Joe Long Young of Lubbock, Texas, and brother Denton Brunken of Liberty Hill, Texas. Ada's memorial service will be held on June 12th at 10 a.m. at her residence. Many thanks to Hospice of Midland for helping in her final days. Rest in peace, Ada Ray Duke. You are missed. Carol Ann Leon Midkiff. Carol Ann Leon Midkiff, age 84, passed away peacefully on July 3rd. She was born June 2, 1936, in Baird, Texas, to Jonna Josephine McGowan Leon and C.D. Toad Leon. She was married to Thomas Oscar T.O. Midkiff on May 21, 1982. Carol Ann is survived by her sons Ben Calloway and wife Cheryl, Al Calloway and wife Stomi, her sister Sandra Leon Roberts and husband Square, 5 grandchildren, 4 great-grandchildren, and several nieces, nephews, and cousins. Graveside service will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, July 10th at Fairview Cemetery in Midland. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to Haley Memorial Library and Research Center at 1805 West Indiana Avenue, Midland, Texas, 79701, or a charity of your choice. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Wells Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Jesse Joe J.J. Madrid Jr. Jesse Joe J.J. Madrid Jr., 30, returned to God on July 4, 2020 in Odessa, Texas due to a motor vehicle accident. As a veteran of the global war on terrorism, Jesse served honorably for 8 years before returning home to Texas. Jesse was born on August 9, 1989 in Midland, Texas. He is survived by his son Alex, mother Linda, father Jesse Sr., sisters Brittany and Jacqueline, and brothers Christopher, Julian, and Christian. A private ceremony for immediate family only due to COVID-19 restrictions will take place in Midland on June 10th. Jesse's remains will be interred with fellow veterans at Fort Sam Houston National Cemetery, San Antonio, Texas. Please give flowers and donations to the ones that need it most in your life, and honor Jesse by living every day to the fullest. Funeral arrangements are entrusted to Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Maria Avila Cordova. Maria Avila Cordova went home to be with our Lord Jesus Christ on July 3, 2020, at the age of 56, after fighting a good fight to liver cancer. She was born on January 23, 1964, in Sonora, Texas, to Hazel Avila and Higinia Campos. She married the love of her life, Roy Marmolejo Cordova, on July 1, 1978. They were married for 42 years. Together they had 6 children. Maria was greeted in heaven by her parents and one sister, Jesusita Ruiz. She's survived by her husband, Roy Marmolejo Cordova, her children, Rosie Cordova, Gilbert, Lori Martinez, Ricky, Christina Gomez, Israel, Roy Cordova Jr., Denise, Roger Cordova, Maddie, and Kathleen Cordova. Her sister, Josephine Cordova, and brothers Domingo Avila, Gabriel Avila, Jose Avila, and Juan Avila. 13 grandchildren and 6 great-grandchildren, and several nieces and nephews. Funeral services for Maria are under the care of Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home in Midland. Family and friends viewing will be on Tuesday, July 7th and Wednesday, July 8th from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m., mask required. On Thursday, July 9th, a service at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home, 1502 North La Mesa Road, will begin at 1 p.m., and interment to follow at Serenity Memorial Garden Cemetery. Funeral will be streamed live on Christina Gomez's Facebook.
Hello, this is Cindy reading from the Odessa American for Wednesday, July 8th. Council Talks Game Rooms by Michael Merlo. During Tuesday's City Council work session, council members and City Manager Michael Marrero discussed game room operations inside city limits. Odessa Mayor David Turner said the city has received a lot of complaints regarding people at packed game rooms in the city who aren't wearing masks. "I would just like to get a survey to find out if they're not following safety protocol," he said. "We may need to close some of the game rooms." Marrero said that the OPD and OFR could check to see if game rooms were following the mask ordinance and Governor Greg Abbott's scaling back of businesses like game rooms to 50% capacity. Turner referenced a game room by his home where he saw around 60 cars in the parking lot consistently. Turner asked Marrero to have game rooms surveyed regarding capacity and masks and then report findings back to council at the next city council meeting. There are reportedly 12 game rooms within city limits. Marrero also asked council if they would want to move meetings back online with an increase in cases to keep city employees and council members safe. He said City Hall would not close down, but with some city employees testing positive with the coronavirus, He said some changes will be happening at City Hall later in the week. All council members said although they would prefer to meet in person, they would be fine with moving back online to reduce risk of virus exposure. A city press release detailed that next week's city council meeting will go back online, and the decision on whether or not to stay virtual will be revisited at the end of each city council meeting. The city will post more information regarding the online meetings on their website and social media. Odessa Fire Rescue Assistant Fire Chief Joy White and Assistant Chief EMS Rod Huber spoke to council regarding the Emergency Operations Center. White said in an interview that they received questions about activation of the EOC. "We're still doing EOC functions," he said, "but that they are working virtually." White said that firefighters are following heat patterns around the city to locate clusters of COVID-19 and to keep other people out of those areas. He said that if the EOC does return to a physical location, it would have to be a big building with a lot of space to keep exposure risks low. "I think the concern is that there's no EOC set up, and physically there's not, but we're still doing the same functions," he said. Towards the end of the meeting, council also appointed Carlos Rodriguez to the Associate Municipal Court Judge position. Rodriguez's application detailed that he is a graduate of Odessa High School and the University of Texas. He received his Juris Doctorate degree from St. Mary's University School of Law in San Antonio and has 2.5 years of public sector legal practice experience. He has been employed as an associate attorney at school law firm in Odessa since 2018 and has also been the Crane City Attorney since 2017. Rodriguez was referred to the position by his aunt Nancy Rodriguez, who is also an employee at the Odessa Municipal Court. Other news, the city also reported that out of the 197 people tested at the Sherwood Park mobile COVID-19 mobile testing, 47 tests came back with confirmed positive results. The next two events are July 14th at Salinas Park and July 16th at UTPB Park from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. The parking lot will open at 7 a.m. Please do not arrive before then. You must remain in your vehicle with a window up until a testing team member approaches you. Only 200 tests will be available at each event for City of Odessa and Ector County residents. Fighting crime. New face takes on OC Academy by Ruth Campbell. With a wide variety of experience to her credit, Nikki Brown is taking on the job of director of Odessa College's Law Enforcement Training Academy. Brown has served 12 years in law enforcement with the St. Louis County Police Department and the O'Fallon Police Department in Illinois. She's also been a field trainer, school resource officer, gang intelligence officer, and academy instructor. "I made it my goal that before my career ended, I wanted to help lead a law enforcement academy. Doing it this early in my career was unexpected, but that became one of my goals," Brown said. Because she had to make sure her Missouri and Illinois certifications were recognized by the state of Texas, her official appointment was June 1st, although her hire date was March 16th. Brown earned a bachelor's degree in criminal justice from Lane College, a master's degree in criminal justice administration from Middle Tennessee State University, and a doctorate in higher education leadership from Maryville University of St. Louis. Currently, the Law Enforcement Training Academy is offering a part-time academy, so one of Brown's goals is to add a full-time academy. "The part-time academy takes about 10 months, and the full-time academy about 6 months. She added that this will be useful, knowing that local police departments are short of officers. Brown said there are now more officers from more departments involved in the academy so students can gain a variety of experience. One of the instructors, William Bess, teaches a lot of the community blocks centering on cultural diversity, cultural competency, diversity and inclusion, and equity. He hones in on those blocks as well as some of the other instructors, Brown said. It's definitely a hot topic, she added. Getting the recruits introduced to it while they're in the academy so they can make the correlation between some of the lessons they've learned and the skill application when it's time to engage with the community, regardless of what their department size is or which counties or cities that they patrol, is important. Brown was at Ferguson, Missouri during the demonstrations there after the death of Michael Brown. The precinct that I was in, the responding precinct, once Ferguson made the request that they needed additional officers, and that kind of started the ball rolling to be 12-hour shifts and closing the precinct, moving the precinct to a different area. The precinct where I worked at the time, which was North County Precinct, or the first precinct, it was right in the midst of a lot of the demonstrations, the protests, Brown said. Asked about the recent cries to defund the police, Brown said there should be consideration of how funds are allocated and how that plays into some of the social dynamics like education, health care, jobs, and employment. All of those may be standalone issues, Brown said, but it may be a good idea to examine ways to reallocate those funds in a different way. Ultimately, she said, all those entries are tied together. If something happens at a school, it could spill over into the community and become a policing issue, when it might be better suited to someone in social services, health care, or mental health. She added that the country is in the middle of dissecting police culture, discussing reform, and how best to add or modify training and understand more of police culture and subculture. We're in a place where the narrative is being rewritten, and we're seeing how the culture is changing with police and may change more in the future, Brown said. The goal is to have the next class start in January 2021. So far, she said, Odessa College has been a great spot to land. It's definitely a hometown feel, Brown said. The criminal justice faculty really took me under their wing, and I would say within my first 24 hours on campus, it felt like a family. I thought, okay, this is home. This is a place where I can definitely grow and learn more about higher education, learn more about policing. I credit a lot of my adjustment to the criminal justice faculty here on campus. Now that she's had a taste of it, Brown said she sees herself staying in education. Some days I do miss it, she said, but then she realizes that education is her purpose and calling. Jennifer Myers, Dean of the School of Business and Industry, said Brown has been a rock star since she arrived. She brings a different kind of perspective for us here. She came from the St. Louis area, so I think she's very passionate about policing, and she's passionate about producing compassionate police officers. I think in this day and age, that's what's really going to benefit our academy, Myers said. Myers added that Brown has been a pleasure to work with since she arrived. She's just really jumped in with both feet, and I'm so glad that she's chosen to be here at Odessa College, and I just really look forward to continuing to work with her. She's going to do great things, and I'm very excited to see what someone with Brown's background can do to help broaden student horizons. Myers said, she just has a vision that aligns with the vision that I have for criminal justice, that Troy Thomas, the department chair, has for criminal justice, and then obviously it aligns with President Dr. Gregory Williams' vision for the college, Meyer said. We want to be the best, and we want to make sure that any professional we graduate is going into their chosen profession and doing a great job being ethically and morally responsible, and having that integrity necessary to do the job well, Myers added. For more information, call 432-335-6580. Middle School Teacher Making Move to Priesthood by Ruth Campbell. For about the past 5 years, Joshua Bass has been thinking about going into the priesthood, and now he's about to take the next steps to fulfill his calling. Bass will be attending Notre Dame Seminary in New Orleans starting in August. He is a member of St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church in Odessa and was a 7th and 8th grade science teacher at Crockett Middle School for 6 years. He taught at Bryan ISD for a year before returning to Ector County ISD. It just kind of kept snowballing. I got more involved in church. It's kind of really just picked up, Bass said. Growing up in Central Texas, Bass was a member of Our Mother of Sorrows Catholic Church in Burnet. He was born and raised a Catholic. Bass said he got more involved in the church as an adult when he moved to Odessa. A combination of things drew him to the church. One of the biggest things in the Acts community at St. Elizabeth's, it's kind of a retreat that you can go on. They have men's, women's, and teens, Bass said. It's not so much a retreat, but it's a big community as well. We do a lot with the church. We have meetings just kind of faith sharing, and we kind of help with anything church needs, Bass said. He will be entering Notre Dame Seminary as a pre-theology. Bass will start with the diocese July 31st and has to be in New Orleans August 9th. The way it kind of works is there's kind of three different levels. There is college seminary. That's for students that generally go to seminary either right out of high school or very little college, and they'll go for 4 years. Then for pre-theology, which is what I'm entering, I already have a college degree, and then I'll go for 2 years for pre-theology. Then after that, you'll enter the theology program, which is another 4 years or so. Once you get done with that, you'll have a pastoral year, and then you'll get ordained a deacon at some point, and then you'll get ordained a priest at the very end. That's if everything goes smoothly, God willing, Bass said. Becoming a priest felt like a calling to him. I could still be a teacher, but I could teach the good works from God, and I could teach the gospel, and I can also be there for the people in a more involved way than just a teacher would be, and I can touch more people's lives, he said. Of course, being a teacher, you touch the lives of children every day, but you can do this for adults and for children at church, the aged. You can do so many different ministries and just so many different things, although I wouldn't have like a traditional family in a sense because Catholic priests don't marry. We don't have families. I still would have a huge family in the church, Bass said. Asked if he would miss the students, he said he would to some extent. In the long run, though, he knows he will be able to work with students and families wherever he is placed. Because once, God willing, I do get ordained, that's kind of what we say because it's definitely not a sure plan. I'm still discerning my life plan and what God is calling me to do, even though through the seminary process. I will be hopefully at a church somewhere, of course. Any church will have religious education programs. But I could still be a teacher, but I could teach the good works from God, and I could teach the gospel, and I can also be there for the people in a more involved way than just a teacher would be, and I can touch more people's lives. Bishop of San Angelo Michael Sis said Bass has been very active at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton, and he will make a fine priest. Josh has been very active in his parish of St. Elizabeth Ann Seton and in a retreat movement called Acts. He is on fire for the Lord, and he wants to commit himself completely to the service of God, Sis stated in an email. He has been well respected as a science teacher in Odessa. Being a teacher is a good preparation for the priesthood, because one of the primary responsibilities of priests is to teach people. A middle school teacher has to have plenty of patience and ability to communicate. If Josh was able to help middle school students comprehend the concepts of science, I believe he will also be able to help people understand the truths of the Christian faith, Sis added. Good teachers and good priests help people to learn and grow. Just as the school district needs excellent teachers, our churches need excellent ministers. Bass earned a health education degree from Texas A&M University and got a master's in counseling from University of Texas Permian Basin. Honestly, I think the counseling is going to help a lot as well in the formation process, he said. Seminary life will be quite structured with classes, daily mass, and ministries. Bass said his parents live in Coleman. He has a brother, sister-in-law, and niece in South Carolina and extended family in Central Texas. COVID-19 news by the numbers. Ector County total cases, both confirmed and probable, 1,392. Ector County negative, 6,831. Out of 9,361 tested, with 1,138 pending, 17 deaths. Recovered, 522. Active, 859. Midland County, 927 confirmed cases, with 17 deaths. Texas, 210,585 confirmed, with 2,471,029 tested. Total Texas deaths, 2,715. U.S. cases, 2,932,596 total confirmed, and 130,133 deaths. Find out more at co.ector.tx.us or dshs.state.tx.us. 11th COVID-19 death at MCH. A 91-year-old woman died from COVID-19 complications Monday night at Medical Center Hospital. MCH detailed in a press release that the woman, who had pre-existing conditions, was a resident at Siena Nursing and Rehabilitation in Odessa and was hospitalized on July 3rd. This is the 11th COVID-19 related death at MCH. As of 2 p.m. Tuesday, MCH recorded that 555 people have tested positive for the virus, and 40 of them are in the hospital. 17 patients are on 7 central, including 2 patients from Siena Nursing and Rehabilitation, and 1 patient from Focused Care at Odessa. 9 patients are on 8 central, including 1 patient from Focused Care at Odessa, and 1 patient from Permian Basin Community Center Group Home. 14 patients are in the critical care unit, including 1 patient from Siena Nursing and Rehabilitation, and 1 patient from Kermit. 8 patients in the CCU are reportedly on ventilators. MCH reported that no persons under investigation are in the hospital, and 523 tests are pending. Quick hits. Early voting. The Ector County and Midland County Elections Office has scheduled early voting through Friday for the joint primary runoff election on July 14th. Early voting polling locations and times in Odessa. Ector County Courthouse Annex, Room 104, 1010 East 8th Street, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. through Friday. Murray Fly Elementary, Foyer, 11688 West Westview Drive, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. through Friday. Westlake Hardware Store, 4652 East University Boulevard, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. through Friday. Odessa College Sports Center, Foyer, 201 West University Boulevard, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. through Friday. Salinas Community Building, 600 West Clement Street, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. through Friday. Sample ballots are available at the following websites. Ector, www.co.ector.tx.us/default. www.co.asps?Ector County/elections. Midland, www.co.midland.tx.us/departments/elections/pages/default.aspx. Secretary of State, www.sos.state.tx.us. Election day is July 14th, and polls were open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Voters may vote at any of the vote centers on this day. For more information, call the Elections Office at 498-4030 in Odessa or 688-4890 in Midland. Visit www.co.ector.tx.us/default.asps?Ector_county/elections or check the local newspaper.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.